Hello and welcome to Homestead Hens and Honey, a beekeeping, chicken keeping, and general homesteading podcast. I'm your host, Gemma, and today I'm doing a relaxed fit style episode where I'll share some of what I did while I was away for spring break, and then also what's kind of going on right now at my homestead. First things first, it occurred to me when I was going back through this year's episodes that I never actually followed up on my first episode of the year where I mentioned that I had another breast anomaly that required further testing. And in case anyone else remembers that and has actually been wondering, I just wanted to say that that was all fine. Everything worked out okay. So it's back to my usual recommended diagnostics again, which means a breast MRI next month and then a mammogram 6 months after that. So there's my little update. Things are still good. Consider this your monthly reminder to do a breast check. This includes men, especially if you have a family history of breast and or colon cancer. Moving on from my tartars, I was lucky enough to spend spring break in Florida with my in-laws, which was really lovely. It's also why I don't have my Higgins the Tortoise episode ready. Well, it's partly because of that. I didn't do any podcast work at all while we were away because I really wanted to enjoy my holiday. And then when I got back, things have been pretty busy. Once April arrived, we finally had some nice weather, so I've been outside as much as humanly possible. If it's a choice between research or working on the podcast and being outside in my garden, I'm going to choose the garden every time. Sorry, not sorry. So, spring break. The one thing I wanted to talk about mainly is the biggest draw for me when we go there is the Circle B Bar Reserve. And this is a nature reserve which has an abundant amount of animals, including alligators, all kinds of water birds, armadillos, everything. I actually wanted to quote from their website because it's such a good summary. Circle B Bar Reserve on the northwest shore of Lake Hancock is a former cattle ranch that today boasts a wide variety of plants and animals. You can see several distinct ecosystems in the reserve of 1,267 acres. You're almost guaranteed to see alligators in Lake Hancock, often considered the headwaters of the Peace River, which flows more than 100 miles from Polk County southwest to the Gulf of Mexico. Polk County and the Southwest Florida Water Management District acquired Circle B Bar Reserve in December 2000 to protect the valuable water and wildlife resources and to restore the Banana Creek marsh system. So this place is just absolutely amazing for alligator and bird sightings. Usually when we're out walking, we come across mostly birders, many of which have huge professional cameras patiently waiting for the perfect shots of their bird of choice. And actually my last visit, so this recent one, was my personal best for gators. I've never seen so many before. When you're walking a lot of the trails, there is a swampy riverway on one side and then the large lake on the other. And usually I see alligators in the swampy, smaller watering area. I very rarely have seen them actually out fully in the lake. But we went sort of early-ish morning and it was the lake was just filled with them swimming around, hanging out, coming up onto the shore. It was incredible. I've never seen so many. And I love crocodilians. So my husband and I had a great time. In regards to birds, I went to do a list of everything and then realized the website actually has a really good list, so I'm going to quote them again. The ongoing restoration in the Banana Creek Marsh has provided foraging and breeding areas for a number of species never recorded on the site before. In 2008, the reserve was added to the Great Florida Birding Trail. Be on the lookout for alligators, eagles, osprey, red-shouldered hawks, wild turkeys, barred owls, wood storks, white ibis, sandhill cranes, moorhens, pied-billed grebes, black-necked stilts, red-bellied woodpeckers, bobwhite quails, eastern meadowlarks, savannah sparrows, American kestrels, great blue herons, American white pelicans, sandpipers, spoonbills, great egrets, ducks, and other waterfowl and wading birds. You might also see otters, bobcats, grey fox, armadillos, squirrel. You might see a squirrel of the grey and fox varieties, frogs, turtles, black racer snakes, five-lined race runner lizards, and other reptiles. Many migratory birds can be found here in the winter months. And of that epic list, we actually saw, I'd say, a good 50% of the birds. There's always osprey, which are my favourite bird. Not as many as last year's spring break, where I was astounded by just how many osprey there were on the day that we went. But there were still some. We also saw the bald eagle's nest and they had chicks. They were very far away and my binoculars weren't quite good enough to see the chicks, but I could make out like a little fuzzy lump. We also saw a great blue heron nest, which had chicks, and I was close enough to see those awkward looking babies. So that was great. And then obviously we saw like some armadillos and obviously squirrels, with lots of frogs, lots of turtles, including one of my favorites, which is the Florida soft shell. I'll post a picture on my Instagram. I just love them. They have really piggy little noses and kind of an awkward looking face. So they're great fun. And a new one for me is I saw a white pelican, which I have not seen there before. And that was really, really good. So other stuff that we did while we were there, I won't go too much into it. You know, we mainly just hung out with family, ate good food, napped a lot, really took it easy. My sister-in-law asked me to do aerial silks with her again, which I did. And as always, was left very sore afterwards. I'll put pictures on my Instagram of me hanging upside down, which is about the most I can do there. It might be the last time I do aerial silks. With her, I love it and I love watching other people perform. I think it's absolutely incredible and it requires so much strength and control. But I don't know how good of an idea it is to do with my back condition, and I could feel the crunchy vertebras that happen sometimes while doing some of the maneuvers. So I kind of feel like it's not really something I should do too often. I'm just worried about really injuring myself. But I'm glad I got to do it. And as always, it was just super fun. And everyone who goes there is lovely. And I can't remember if I mentioned this last year. No, probably not. Was I even podcasting last year? Anyway, the previous spring break, one thing that I did with my sister-in-law is mermaiding. And mermaiding, for anyone who doesn't know, is where you wriggle your way into a mermaid tail and go swimming. And let me tell you, it is so much fun. It's very, very involved. You have to get like these plastic or rubber flipper things that then go into the tail. And then there's another plastic thing that helps hold the tail shape. And then you wriggle into the actual flexible material part of the tail and then go swimming. And you want to go swimming in springs if you can, because chlorine water will damage your tail and salt water can be a bit too aggressive for them as well. And thankfully, Florida is blessed with an abundance of springs. So we went to one that was not too far from the house, about 35 minutes out. The previous year we went to a really beautiful springs that's a good 2 hours away and it was worth it, but that's a lot of driving and we didn't quite feel like it this year. I will say that it takes a while to get used to the tail, but it's very fun and I really get a kick out of this hobby that is just so playful. I know some people would maybe think it's childish, but But I love it. I love when adults embrace quote unquote childish things just for the sheer joy of doing it. And it's definitely something that I love and I hope to continue doing when I visit her. So we had this lovely holiday. We came back because we had people looking after the dogs and then someone else looking after the chickens and the reptiles. I came back and there wasn't a lot to immediately do. All the animals were in really good shape. Everyone seemed happy and content. I was really, really pleased. But we did return to storms. When we left Cleveland, it was snowing. And when we arrived in Florida, it was a quote unquote cold spell of about 50 degrees for 2 days, which was great hiking weather and we made the most of it. Then it went back up to 84. When we got back, there had been very, very high winds again and storms. And so I returned to my yard being flooded and a huge branch that had fallen down inside the fence area, thankfully did not hit anything. So there's no damage. It didn't even fall on any of the daffodils somehow. The biggest mystery is that we can't figure out what tree it came from. Like, we're looking at the trees and we cannot see where this just disconnected from, which is bizarre, but it's too big to remove. We're going to have to get the chainsaw out, which means me being supervised because I'm not allowed to use it by myself because I'm very clumsy. So, but yeah, it didn't damage anything. So that was great. And even though we kind of returned to storms, there are signs that spring is truly here, or at least desperately trying to assert itself. So aside from the flooding, which happens every spring, the frogs, you can hear them in the back now, mainly the spring peepers and wood frogs. The duck pair that visits us every year has returned and has actually been hanging out inside the fence. Our daffodils were blooming when we returned. A number of our shrubs were starting to bud up. And there's also some very, very small wildflowers in the lawn. And just this week, we have our first dandelion flowers. So feeling springish, or at least that it's, you know, maybe on its way, I had to start prepping things. So I did a big seed order, which was so much fun. I love ordering seeds. I think it's one of those things that homesteaders really, really enjoy. And then I was thinking that I need to start putting my raised beds together. So that's sort of on the agenda when I have the time, and I'm hoping to do it outside. So right now we've had a lot of rain, and so I'm just waiting for my best dry day to get that done. I also had a really good opportunity to take the baby Orpingtons, who Maybon and Litha, who have been living in the quarantine coop. I got the chance to integrate them with the main flock. That just happened. So I did the pop-up run inside the primary run so that they could see each other. They would fight a bit through the mesh, you know, the usual kind of chickeny things. And then because today was supposed to have a very sudden temperature drop, I decided to release them into the run and integrate properly during snack time. So the chickens were kind of distracted by snacks. And that actually went really well. I came back after a while and Litha was fighting the Wellsummer, who I still haven't named, which is terrible. I really need to figure out what I'm going to call that one. But anyway, she was fighting the Wellsummer and it was pretty funny because she quickly won. And then a ginger hen came over and also fought the Wellsummer to make it clear that the Wellsummer is the bottom of the pecking order, poor thing. I did go out after dark. I really wanted to make sure that they were in the coop with everyone and they hadn't, you know, retreated into the crate that I had left in the run. And thankfully, they were in the coop. And not just that, but they were roosting together, actually perched on the edge of their big dust bath. And the rooster was perching sort of near and just above them, seeming quite protective of them already. So that's nice. I feel relatively optimistic about how things are going to go with them. But today will be a good test. I will spend some time out there when it's not raining and see how they have integrated. Speaking of chickens, I am having some minor issues with my frizzle mama, Petal. I'm not sure if I ever told the story about picking up Petal, but I got her from a local hatchery when I got my Easter eggers and my Welsomers. And I didn't realize until I got her home that she actually had this back wound. So it looked like she had scraped the entirety of her back, like right down to her tail. And it was just all scabby and it looked terrible. And I actually took her to the vet because my concern was that it could have been some kind of skin condition. I really wanted someone with better experience to be able to tell me if this is an injury or if this is something else. And, you know, it was decided it was an injury. He gave me a cream to treat it. And she eventually, you know, healed and her feathers started coming in. Well, as her feathers started coming in, I think it must have been relatively itchy. And she would start preening. And then inevitably she'd snap a blood feather. And once she saw the blood, she'd start picking at it even worse. So I had to be quite aggressive about keeping the area covered with a hen saddle and with various products that deter like plucking and picking. And so eventually she fuzzed out and it was fine. Well, now in spring, she started plucking her feathers again and it's the same area, it's her back. And she's plucked herself completely bald right underneath her tail. And she has like an area on her neck into her chest that she's been plucking as well. And I have no idea what's going on. I don't know if it's just that she's developed this habit and it's one of those self-rewarding behaviors. You know, she starts plucking, it irritates the skin. She sees the redness. She starts plucking more because of the redness, because they're attracted to the color red. And then it just goes and spirals. So right now I have her in a hen saddle again, one that's extra long. And I've been treating it and trying to deter her from getting at it. But it's just bizarre. I don't know why she's like this. I'm hoping to enlarge the run for that smaller coop. And maybe that will help give her more things to do. If not, I'll find some enrichment toys or items that I can put in there and see if it's just a case of keeping the area covered and keeping her distracted. Something else that I was doing and I need to get a move on with is I mentioned before that we're going to be fencing in the side property and round the back because we've had just, you know, a lot of stray dogs and the neighbors' dogs crossing through. And ultimately, this culminated in a husky that killed one of my Welsomers. And that was like the final straw for us. So speaking to my husband about it, we were going to do it ourselves. And I said to him, you know, why don't I just go ahead and get a quote just to see what it would be like if we were paying someone else to do it. So I contacted a company and that specializes in agricultural fencing. And I had them come out and, you know, great guy. The products look amazing. They have really great testimonials, but it was ridiculously expensive. And I remember how much it was when we had our vinyl fence done. And this was more expensive than having the vinyl fencing, even though it's supposed to be a more affordable option. And I don't know if this is because I know that the pandemic made materials really expensive. It is kind of an awkward area. So I don't know if that's increasing the materials used to like get around things. But it was just one of those things where we looked at it and we were just like, well, this is an obvious no. And it wasn't just an obvious no. It's like, I don't know if I'm ever going to do this. Even in the future, if we suddenly were given like the money and we could do anything we want with it, I'm not sure I want to invest it in that. So we're going to do it ourselves. I'm actually thinking about sort of a temporary style fence that I can then take down in winter so it doesn't get collapsed during the heavy snow and it doesn't get like the posts don't all fall down when the ground floods. So we're looking into that. It's still, I think all the materials will come to about 1,000, maybe 2, because we're going to need a lot of posts and a lot of actual netting or like the wire fencing, but that's a lot better than our quote, which was over 11,000. I don't know how anyone fences anything. It must be why these properties that go on the market and they've already put the fences in and they've already separated the paddocks so that you can, you know, rotate your livestock. It's no wonder they cost a fortune, because we're not even looking at fencing in half an acre and it was over 11K. That's just absolutely ridiculous. Anyway, so that's something I need to get a move on. I need to start investigating the materials that I need. I'm going to see if I can get like any bulk deals, and I'm going to do my best to keep the price as low as possible because I am cheap and I just don't want to spend a lot of money this year. Last year was really expensive and I'd really like to see our savings account be growing nicely during this year. Kind of on the line of money coming in, my pink tongue skink mamas are looking very chunky. When we returned, one of them actually, when they get closer within like a couple of weeks to giving birth, they, much like human mamas, start to just look really, really fed up. They tend to move very little. They will bask a lot during the morning under the heat lamp, and then they'll move to the cooler side and they just sort of sit there looking fed up and heavy breathing. And one of my mamas, Callisto, this is going to be her first pregnancy. She looks like that already. So I moved her into a birthing tank and she's not eating. That's another sign that we're getting close. And then this week, my female Pandora, who I have bred before, she was resting last year after she'd had kind of a rough birth. She was paired with a new male and she is also getting that slightly fed up look to her. So I moved her into a birthing tank as well. But as of this week, she is still eating about half of her normal amount. So I don't think she's as close as Callisto. And then the other two mamas, Europa and Io, they seem to not be as far along. So I'm not sure if Europa definitely took again this year. This is sort of my test year for her because her male Titan has had a hemipenal abscess in the past. I'm not sure if he can still get the job done. So if she doesn't produce for me this year, Titan will be retired and I will put another male in with her for next year. But she is looking kind of sausagey. So either she's just really fat again or she's pregnant. And as for Io, this is her first pregnancy as well. I actually thought she was a boy for a while, but it turns out that she's not a boy. She is definitely a female. She is probably sort of third along. So I would say Callisto is probably going to pop first, then Pandora, then Io, and then hopefully Europa. So watch this space. I'm really excited to get babies this year. Having the break was actually wonderful in a lot of ways, but I just love the whole process so much, and I really love connecting with customers who have been desperately looking for one of these animals for a long time, and being the person who can give them that is really special. And not to be crass, but the additional income is also really nice. It's like getting a little windfall every summer, and it's going to go right into the savings account. So fingers crossed. And in terms of crossing fingers, because it's always something going on with my lot, my Pictus gecko female, I think, might be egg bound. And so basically, with the Pictus geckos, they're incredibly fertile. They will produce eggs, usually two eggs, because that's all they can fit in their little bodies. They're quite small. I'll try and get a picture up on my Instagram so that people can see. They produce two eggs quite frequently. Like, I think it's something like once a month or something. And she's been producing infertile eggs since I've had her and since she reached sexual maturity. I do eventually plan to breed her, but it's kind of low priority, so I've always just waited. And she has had these ginormous eggs in her for a while now, and I couldn't tell whether they were stuck in there or whether she was just producing eggs so fast, because she's at her peak reproductive age now, that she was producing the eggs and then just growing new ones. And I was missing the laying of them, because when they're laid, they're very, very small and they actually fall apart very easily, especially when they're infertile. And because she's in a natural enclosure, sometimes I miss them. Well, this week has been our tester week. So basically what I've done this week is every single day I've checked on her to see if she still has eggs in her. And I'm afraid to say that she does. And so I think I'm going to have to call my vet and get her in. I don't think they are necessarily obstructed. So she's still passing feces and urate, so they're not constricting her digestive system. But my concern is that for whatever reason, she's not being stimulated to actually lay them. So I'm hoping that some oxytocin injections and maybe moving her into a smaller, darker area will help pass things through. If not, I don't really know what our next steps are. She's so tiny. I'm not sure if surgery would even be an option, but that's why I am going to see my vet. So I need to make that phone call. Hopefully I can get her in next week and we can get that poor little thing sorted. She's just so swollen. I don't know if I can get a picture of how big these eggs are because she's quite skittish and I obviously don't want to stress her out more. But if I can, I will, and I'll put them on Instagram. So the biggest thing that you know I care about, and I'm sure a lot of you do as well, is my honeybees. So now that we're kind of moving into spring, what's going on with my bees? I'm really bummed to admit that I am down to two colonies. So I went into winter with 7 or 6.5 because one was that tiny little colony that I wasn't sure if they could make it, but I had them in a nuke box. I had a lot of honey for them and I felt like it was worth a shot. That's the one I lost to equipment failure. Water got in and they died from that. My top bar hive, I already said, I think died, well, I know died from mites. And then since then, I've lost all but two. And it's interesting to me that the two survivors are Saskatraz bees. So one is the Saskatraz queen that I purchased last year. And the other one is one of her offspring. So I took eggs from my Saskatraz queen, and I let the colony raise their own queen. So it's a Saskatraz Ohio mix of bees. Every single Varroa sensitive hygiene colony that I had, including one that was a hybrid between a VSH queen and local bees, they all died. And it's interesting what went on with some of them. So one of them died. It looks like they started producing brood and didn't have enough bees to maintain appropriate temperatures. And when we had a sudden freeze, I think that's what killed them. The other one is a lot more interesting. It was alive for a long time. It's died within the last couple of weeks. And what's so fascinating is I opened it up and it was filled with dead drones. So almost no worker bees were left and it was just packed with drones. And so for me, what I think might have happened is one of two things. Either the queen was poorly mated. So she was one that I let the colony raise last year. And it was slightly later into the spring and summer than the sort of ideal mating time based on drone availability. And so my idea is either she was poorly mated and when she came through the winter, she used up all of her fertile eggs, all of her sperm that she'd stored, and then all she could produce were the infertile eggs that become drones. And so eventually the colony perished because drones are just for going out and having sex with virgin queens. They don't do any work inside the hive. They're not bringing in food, but they eat twice as much food as a worker and so on. My other theory is that something happened to her and she died and a worker started laying, and that's why we have so many drones, because workers can only lay infertile eggs. Either way, I've never seen this before, and it's very interesting to me, and it kind of helps soothe the loss, because it just feels it's new, it's a challenge, it's something to think about. It feels like it's given me, I don't know, new knowledge that hopefully will come into play sometime. I don't know. I like to be able to figure out what the reason is when I can. It makes me feel like the loss isn't completely pointless because I'm learning something. And that's why I'm sharing it with you. You know, I'll be honest, I feel a lot of disappointment in myself that I had such a bad winter, because I didn't have a great winter the one before. I think the best winter I ever had was actually my very first winter, where I got both colonies through. And since then, it just feels like it's been kind of going downhill. And I feel a lot of shame about it, because it makes me question, like, what the fuck am I doing? Am I one of those people who intellectually has all this knowledge about beekeeping, but in practice, I'm just flubbing everything? I don't know. But what I do know is that doing the same thing over and over and over again and always getting the same results is madness. And so thinking about things that I can change moving forward, I've identified two key areas. And the first one is just being in the hives more. So last year I had to take a break from the hives a couple of times, one because I was away in Canada, which I don't regret. I really wanted to go. It was amazing getting to see my bestie and explore that area with her. It's just beautiful. But it did take away my time with the bees. Then I come back and I have COVID, so I couldn't work the bees because I was so sick. I also had a surgery where I couldn't lift things for a certain period of time. So that beekeeping period, it was much longer than I thought it would be. It was a solid month of just not doing anything in there during a time when we really need to be keeping an eye out for mite levels and making sure that they're beginning to store enough for winter and so on. So that's the one thing, is like this year I'm really going to do my best to be in there every 7 to 10 days without fail, no exceptions. And the second thing is, I have always really believed in the things that I've read and I've talked to other keepers about in terms of not treating for mites unless I have a mite count that tells me it's an issue. And the reason I feel so strongly about this is because, you know, early on when mites hit the US and started to decimate populations, treatments were used so excessively that the mites developed basically immunity or resistance. They just weren't responding to the treatments anymore. And some of those treatments are now no longer used at all, because we know that the mites can resist them. And so for me, I was really, really resistant to contributing to potentially over-treating and letting the mites evolve to be more resistant to the treatment, therefore weakening the efficacy of whatever treatment we were using. And so I've always done mite tests before I treat. I'm very strict about threshold levels of mites before I treat. And I have followed advice to mix up the treatments that I use. So I started with Apivar. I've tried since then HopGuard and then MiteAway Quick Strips, which is the formic acid. And I have sporadically used oxalic acid, usually with the help of someone else, because I have done the vaporization and I don't have a vaporizer. So I've borrowed one, or I had like my package was vaporized for me when I collected it, which I thought was a good idea. So I'm sick of doing that. I feel like it's not working. I feel like this is a key part of my failures. And so this year, I am treating on a schedule. And the schedule that I will be using is kindly shared by one of my local beekeeping supply stores and queen producers. And their name is Queen Right Colonies. And they very kindly have this full beekeeping calendar, which breaks down the year by months and gives advice on what should be done in each month, such as like expanding the brood nest, honey supering, treatments, you know, making splits or nukes, thinking ahead to whether you want to be selling nukes the following year. Like, it really covers a lot. And like I said, it's broken down by month. So you can go in at the beginning of every month, see what's recommended and do it. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to follow this beekeeping calendar religiously. You know, Queen Right Colonies is not super far away from me. They've been producing bees in this same environment that I'm working with for years and years and years, and are very successful. They're very good at what they do. And I just think it's time that if they say that treating on a schedule is what has helped them improve overwintering, then I'm going to give it a go. So I'm going to share the link to their beekeeping calendar in the episode description. It was written by Denzel St. Clair, who I believe is one of the owners of Queen Right. And I've already started using it as a basis. And part of that means figuring out oxalic acid vaporization. Now, I think I've mentioned before that my neighbor who has bees kind of designed his own vaporizer. I'll take a picture of it. It's basically, he designed like a copper like tubing and like well area where you put the oxalic acid that screws into a propane torch. So it comes up to temperature faster and you can just pop along a row of hives really quickly, vaporizing. The problem, which you'll see when I take a picture of it, is that the tubing that you actually put into the hive for treatment is short. So with a one style vaporizer, which is what is the main thing on the market, which you're probably all familiar with, it's a very long wand. So you can go through the front entrance and push it, you know, near the back or in the middle, do its thing, pull it out, etc. This thing, he recommends that you drill a hole in the bottom board underneath the screen. Then you put the tubing through and it vaporizes from sort of that back area. And he loves it and he has success with it. I don't like it. So this was my first year actually using it. And I don't like it because you end up very, very close to the hive with your torch and the copper. And I singed every hive. It was just unavoidable that if it touches for even a second, the bottom board singes. The bee wrap shifted and briefly fell down and then started melting onto the copper. I mean, it's just, you're very, very close. And at least for someone like me, who is famously clumsy, I just felt like it was a fire hazard. And I also didn't like how close I am to it when the vapor starts coming out. So even though I'm wearing, you know, appropriate PPE, you know, I'm wearing the appropriate ventilator mask, I'm wearing the goggles over my glasses, you know, everything like that, I really felt like I was just so close to the vapor and it made me uncomfortable. So what I've decided is within the next 2 weeks, I will be getting a call about my package that I ordered of bees. It will be ready for pickup. And when I go and pick it up, I'm going to buy the recommended starter vaporizer that Queen Right Colonies sells. And I'm going to familiarize myself with it, learn how to use it, and start using it. Queenwright recommends treating on a every other month schedule, and you do three treatments within that time. So you go in, you treat, you wait a certain period of days, you treat again, you wait another period of days, you treat the third time. And this is just because, you know, oxalic acid doesn't penetrate capped brood. So you're trying to capture all those mites as broods are, you know, hatching and growing and so forth. Like I said, I'm going to pop that, the beekeeping calendar, into my episode description. And that actually leads me to just a quick update. I have been maintaining a website that goes with this podcast so that if you need to go back and see anything that I've discussed or go find links or whatever, it's right there on my website. I am going to be getting rid of my website within a year. So the issue that I've had with it is that there's limited photo storage. And gone are the days when you could keep a million photos in your photo bucket account for free. Now everywhere that will allow you to upload media charges. And the website, which is Wix, W-I-X.com, I really like their design templates. That's why I use them. But their paid services are expensive. And I'm just not spending that money on a website, particularly because I actually don't think a lot of people are going there. I get just a handful of hits. I'm not sure it's really being utilized by my listeners. And so if you guys aren't using it, you don't need it. It's more work for me. I don't want to pay to have more storage. Even looking at some other blogging platforms, that the pay is much less. So I think WordPress or something, you can pay like $4 a month and have like 2 gigabytes of storage or something. But, you know, if you want an unlimited amount of storage so that you can put the photos up with every single post and keep all the old pictures so that your whole website is, you could click from 3 years ago and still be able to see my photos, you have to pay for unlimited storage and it's too expensive and I'm just done. So moving forward, I'm going to keep the website going for a year. If there's anything that you've been waffling about finding on my website, you know, sometimes I post links to different websites or, you know, videos or anything that you might have thought, oh, I need to get that. You have a year to get that information and then I will be closing down the website. So moving forward, what I'll be doing is the photos that I take, which I used to take for the blog posts, will now just be putting on Instagram with the appropriate episodes. You can find the episode through Instagram and then just scroll through the photos and you'll see whatever I talked about. There will be pictures of it there. Otherwise, I will be using the episode descriptions for all links. So I have tried to be a bit more mindful about doing that. And moving forward, that will be the only way I'm sharing links and references and things like that. So I'll put that all in the episode description so that you can find it easily when you listen to this podcast. And I think that's it. I think that's my news. Trying to think if there's anything else that I need to update on. I am feeling very excited about spring. I am raring to go. I already have a number of projects. I'm desperately trying to be ready. Like the minute I can start putting seeds in the ground, I want to be ready. And that's going to take a little bit of time, mainly because we have had so many high winds lately that yard cleanup is really a big thing right now. So I always lose branches over this period of time through winter into spring, but there is a lot and there's lots of large branches that are going to need to be cut up. There's lots of twigs everywhere. There's just a huge mess. It's just me doing the work. So it's going to take a really long period of time. And while I'm doing that, some of the weeds are already growing. So weeding will start very soon as well. I will be putting my raised beds together. I'm reassessing various areas of the garden. So I'm moving some beds to areas that I think have better sun. And it's just kind of go, go, go. And also I need to get that fence up so that as soon as the foliage really starts to grow in and offer cover from above, I can let my chickens roam again, because they definitely want to be out. And I love it when they're free roaming. So I want to get a move on. I'm sure wherever you are, unless you're in Australia, you're feeling the same way. For some of my listeners who are in southern states, you probably are already digging right into spring with various plants and flowers, and your bees are probably bursting with brood, and you're already trying to prevent swarming and all that kind of good stuff. Very envious of you right now. I would love that. My two surviving colonies, my Saskatraz colonies, I went in the other day and there's no brood, but they are extremely content. So I can only hope that the queens just haven't started laying yet. I also actually didn't see the queens and that freaked me out, but I know what a queenless colony sounds like. It's a very distinctive noise that once you've heard it, you will remember it forever. These are both very happy, very big, seemingly healthy, content colonies. So I suspect what happened is that if she's not laying yet, she'll be smaller than I'm used to. And I missed her under all of the bees scurrying around, and she was fast enough to get out of sight. But watch this space, because knowing my bloody luck, I'll be back here in a week telling you that I'm totally queenless and everything's gone to shit. So on that cheerful note, I will go. Next episode will be up next week. I'm going to try and keep the weekly episodes going. Thank you for being patient while I took 2 weeks away. I really needed the break and it was lovely. And next week's episode will be about Higgins, my beloved Russian tortoise. And depending on how the next week goes, maybe I'll have some good news about the bees. Maybe I'll be telling you about picking up my package. I don't know. But yeah, follow along with me. This will be very, well, not very, but slightly different, you know, updating every week. Kind of, you can experience spring through summer with me directly, and I hope that it makes for enjoyable listening. Speaking of, and I promise this is the last thing, I mentioned on my Instagram that I started listening to a podcast called Tooth and Claw Podcast, and I just love it. And I actually listened to it a lot while I was away, and I have binged the episodes, and I'm now completely caught up. Tooth and Claw Podcast is about animal encounters. And it's really about taking animal encounters and getting rid of the sensationalism that media puts on them. So they look at stories through the news, through various sources about animals attacking people, and they go through it and they basically say what they think happened. Because usually the humans have done something or stumbled into a situation that has triggered this behavior. You know, most animals are not hunting humans. They're not just bloodthirsty monsters. And what's really wonderful about the podcast is that there are three hosts, and one of them, Wes, is a wildlife biologist and he specializes in bears. So he has wonderful information and firsthand accounts of dealing with grizzly bears and black bears. He's also been really blessed to do field work in a number of areas. So he's also had experience with, I think recently he was doing eagle work, and then he's had experience with like gray whales. I mean, he just has so much to share and seems like a genuinely lovely person. In fact, Wes really supports this idea that I have, that biologists are just generally really sweet people, because I know I'm biased. My husband's a biologist. My best friend is a forensic anthropologist. And through them, I've met so many biologists. And honestly, almost all of them are just so nice and just so interesting. And I generally feel like biologists are my people. So it's really nice that there's more anecdotal evidence to support my theory that biologists are awesome. And the other two hosts are Wes's brother, Jeff. He is, he's not a wildlife biologist, but he has done some technician work in the field with his brother. He's also sort of the funny one, you know, he makes some really funny jokes. He has a lot of interesting stories. And then finally, there's Mike, who is a really good friend of theirs. He's the producer and the kind of big nerd. So if you like, you know, random anime references and nerdy things, that's Mike's probably your guy. Mike also really loves bees, so I'm afraid he's my favorite because he likes bees. So I really, really, really recommend this podcast. I love it. If you like true crime because of the storytelling aspect, but you're kind of uncomfortable with the fact that you're listening to really gruesome violence, this might be a good fit for you because it's almost like animal true crime. So there is some explicit information shared occasionally, but they will give you a heads up. You can always skip that bit. And not all of the stories are gruesome. Some of them are actually kind of funny. You know, some of them, no one is really truly harmed. It's just a good listen. And I think if you love animals, and I assume you do because you're listening to this podcast, that you'll really like it. So I'll leave a link to their website in the episode description, and I really, really recommend you check them out. I just think it's fantastic, and I've really enjoyed listening to them, and I'm definitely going to be keeping an eye on them so I can catch all the future episodes. All right, so that's it. I'll be back next week. I hope that my yard drains, that it gets warmer, and that my queen bees start laying eggs very soon. And I hope everyone listening is doing well, that you're happy, you're healthy, you're enjoying the weather, and you are getting out there. So until next time, remember, hug your hens and then wash your hands. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.